four under the control of each 767. If the American fighters came closer, they'd be made to pay for it. He had to risk one open transmission, and even over an encrypted burst channel it made the colonel nervous, but the business entailed risks under the best of circumstances. Lightning lead to lightning flight, separate in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, separate. He pulled back on the stick, jerking his fighter up and away from the Strike Eagle that had spent the last half hour in his jet wash. At the same instant, his right hand flipped off the radar transponder that he'd had on to boost the return signal the Japanese AEW aircraft had been taking off his aircraft. Behind and below, the F-15E and its female flight crew would be diving slightly and turning left. The Lightning climbed rapidly, in the process losing almost all of its forward velocity. The colonel punched burners for rapid acceleration and used the thrust vector capability of the aircraft to initiate a radical maneuver in the opposite direction, greatly speeding the separation. The Japanese radar might or might not have gotten some sort of return off his fighter, the colonel knew, but he knew how the radar system was working now. It was operating at high power and getting all sorts of spurious returns as a result, which the computer system had to classify before presenting them to the system controllers. In essence, it did a job no different from that of human operator, albeit quickly and efficiently, but it was not perfect, as he and the three other Lightnings were about to prove. Turning south, the controller reported, unnecessarily, as four separate people were now monitoring the progress of the inbounds. Neither he nor his fellows could know that the computer had noted a few ghostly returns turning north, but these had been weaker than other returns that were not moving rapidly enough to be classified as aircraft, nor did they mimic the probable flight paths of aircraft. Then things got harder. Getting jamming from the inbounds. The lead Lightning was now in a nearly vertical climb. There was danger in this, since the flight profile offered the E-767 the least stealthy aspect of the aircraft, but it was also offered no lateral motion to speak of, and so could well appear to be a ghost return, especially in the electronic clutter being generated by the powerful jammers on the Strike Eagles. In less than 30 seconds, the Lightnings tipped over to level flight at an altitude of 55,000 feet. The colonel was paying very close attention to his threat system now. If the Japanese had him, they would show it by using their electronic scanning to hammer his fighter with radar energy. But they weren't. The stealthy nature of his fighter was enough that he was lost amid the trash returns. The system caught side lobes now. The E-767 had shifted to its high-frequency fire control mode and was not targeted on him. Okay. He boosted power to supercruise, and his Lightning accelerated to 1,000 miles per hour as the pilot selected fire control mode for his HUD system. 1 o'clock high. I have him, Sandy, the backseater reported. He even has his AC lights on. The train had stopped at a suburban station, and the Comanche had left it behind, cruising now at 120 knots toward the coastal town. Richter flexed his fingers one last time, looked up, and saw the aircraft's strobe lights far overhead. He was almost under it now, and good as its radar might be, it wouldn't be able to look straight down through the body of the airframe itself. Yes, the center of his threat screen was black now. "Here we go," he said over the intercom. He jammed his throttles to the firewall, deliberately overspooling the engines as he pulled back sharply in the side stick. The Comanche leaped upwards in a spiraling climb. The only real worry here was his engine temperature. They were designed to take abuse, but this would take it to the very limit. A warning indicator appeared in his helmet display, a vertical bar that started growing in height and changing color almost as rapidly as the numbers changed on the altitude display. "Whoa," the backseater breathed. Then he looked down and selected the weapons display for his screens, the better to utilize his time before going back to scanning outside. Negative traffic. Which figured, Richter thought. They wouldn't want people cluttering up the air around something as valuable as this target. That was fine. He could see it now as his helicopter shot through 10,000 feet, climbing like the fighter plane it really was, rotor-driven or not. He could see it in his targeting display now, still too far away to shoot, but there, a blip in a little box in the center of the head-up display. Time for a check. He activated his missile illumination systems. The F-22 had an LPI radar, meaning that there was a low probability of interception at the other end. That proved optimistic. "We just took a hit," the countermeasures officer said. "We just took a high-frequency hit bearing unknown," he went on, looking at his instruments for additional data. "Probably a scatter from us," the senior controller said, busy now with vectoring his fighters onto the still inbound contacts. "No, no. Frequency wasn't right for that." The officer ran another instrument check, but there was nothing else to support the odd feeling that had just turned his arms cold. "Engine heat warning, engine heat warning," the voice was telling him, because he'd ignored the visual display rather blatantly, the onboard computer thought. "I know, honey," Richter replied. Over the Nevada desert, he'd managed a zoom climb to 21,000 feet, so far beyond the normal flight envelope of a helicopter that it had actually frightened him, Richter remembered. But that had been in relatively warm air, and it was colder here. He blazed through 20,000 feet, still with a respectable climb rate, just as the target changed course, turning away from him. It seemed to be orbiting at about 300 knots, probably using one engine for propulsion and the other to generate power for its radar. He hadn't been briefed on it, but it seemed reasonable enough. What mattered was that he had seconds to get within range, but the huge turbofan engines on the converted airliner were inviting targets for his stingers. "Just in range, Sandy. Roger." His left hand selected missiles from his weapons panel. The side doors on the aircraft snapped open. Attached to each of them were three Stinger missiles. With his last vestige of control, he slewed the aircraft around, flipped the cover off the trigger switch, and squeezed six times. All of the missiles blazed off their rails, arcing upwards toward the aircraft 2 miles away. With that, Richter eased way back on the throttles and nosed over, diving and cooling his abused engines, watching the ground, while his backseater followed the progress of the missiles. The first Stinger burned out and fell short. The remaining five did better, and though two of them lost power before reaching the target, four of them found it, three to the right engine and one to the left. Hits, multiple hits. The E-767 at low speed didn't have much of a chance. The Stingers had small warheads, but the civilian spec engines on the aircraft were poorly designed to deal with damage. Both immediately lost power, and the one that had actually been powering the aircraft came apart first. Fragments of turbine blades exploded through the safety casing and ripped into the right wing, severing the flight controls and destroying aerodynamic performance. The converted airliner rolled immediately right and did not recover, its flight crew surprised at the unannounced disaster and quite unable to deal with it. Half of the starboard wing separated from the aircraft almost at once, and on the ground radar operators saw the alphanumeric display marking the position of Kami 2 flip to the emergency setting of 7711 and then simply disappear. "That's a hard kill, Sandy." "Roger." The Comanche was falling rapidly now, heading toward the clutter of the coast. Engine temps were back to normal, and Richter hoped he hadn't done them permanent harm. As for the rest, he'd killed people before. "Kami 2 just dropped off the air," the communications officer reported. "What?" the senior controller asked, distracted by his intercept mission. "Garbled call, explosion, something like that. Then the data links just dropped off." "Stand by. I have to vector my eagles in." It had to be getting twitchy for the 15 Echoes, the colonel knew. Their job for the moment was to be bait, to draw the Japanese eagles out farther over the water while the lightnings went in behind them to chop down their AEW support and spring the trap. The good news for the moment was that the third E-767 had just gone off the air, so the other side of the mission had happened as planned. That was nice for a change. And so, for the rest. "Two, this is lead. Executing now." The colonel flipped his illumination radars on, 20 miles from the orbiting AEW aircraft. Next, he opened the weapons bay doors to give the AMRAAM missiles a chance to see their quarry. Both 1 and 2 had acquisition, and he triggered both off. Fox 2 on the North Guy with 2 slammers. The opening of the weapons bay instantly made the lightnings about as stealthy as a tall building. Blips appeared on 5 different screens, along with additional warnings as to the speed and heading of the newly discovered aircraft. The additional word from the countermeasures officer was the final voice of doom.
"We're being illuminated at very close range, bearing 027.
What? Who is that?"
He had problems of his own, with his Eagles about to launch missiles at the incoming Americans. Commie 6 had just switched to fire control mode to allow the interceptors to fire in the blind launch mode as they'd done with the B-1 bombers. He couldn't stop that now, the senior officer told himself. The last warning was far too late for counteraction. Just 5 miles out, the 2 missiles switched on their own homing radars. They were coming in at Mach 3 plus, driven by solid fuel rocket motors toward a huge radar target, and the AIM 120 AMRAAM, known to its users as the Slammer, was one of the new generation of brilliant weapons. The pilot finally got the word, listening in to the countermeasures channel. He rolled his aircraft left, attempting a nearly impossible split S dive that he knew was a waste of effort, because at the last second he saw the yellow glow of rocket exhaust. "Kill," Lightning Lead whispered to himself.
"Lightning Flight, this is Lead. North Guy is down."
"Lead, this is 3. South Guy is down," he heard next. And now, the colonel thought, using a particularly cruel Air Force euphemism, it was time to kill some baby seals. The 4 Lightnings were between the Japanese coast and 8 F-15J Eagle interceptors. To seaward of them, the F-15E Strike Eagles would be turning back in, lighting off their own radars and loosing their own AMRAAMs. Some would make kills, and the Japanese fighters that survived them would run for home right into his flight of 4. The ground control radars couldn't see the aerial combat taking place. It was too far out and below the radar horizon. They did see 1 aircraft racing for their coast, one of theirs by the transponder code. Then it stopped cold in the air, and the transponder went off. In the Air Defense Headquarters, data downloaded from the 3 dead AEW aircraft gave no clues, except for 1 fact. The war their country had started was now very real and had taken an unexpected turn. Chapter 43 Dancing to the Tune.
"I know you're not Russians," Koga said, sitting in the back of the car with Chavez while Clark did the driving.
"Why would you think that?" John asked innocently.
"Because Yamata thinks that I have been in contact with Americans."
"You two are the only Gaijin with whom I have spoken since this madness began."
"What is going on here?" the politician demanded.
"Sir, what is going on right now is that we rescued you from people who wanted you dead."
"Yamata would not be so foolish as that," Koga retorted, not yet recovered from the shock of seeing violence uncontained by the borders of a TV cabinet.
"He has started a war, Koga-san. What is your death against that?" the man in the driver's seat inquired delicately.
"So, you are Americans," he persisted.
"Oh, what the hell," Clark thought.
"Yes, sir, we are."
"Spies?"
"Intelligence officers," Chavez preferred. "The man who was in the room with you..."
"The one you killed, you mean, Kaneda?"
"Yes, sir. He murdered an American citizen, a girl named Kimberly Norton, and I am actually rather happy that I took him down."
"Who was she?"
"She was Goto's mistress," Clark explained, "and when she became a political threat to your new prime minister, Raizo Yamata decided to have her eliminated. We came to your country just to get her home, that was all," Clark went on, telling what was partially a lie.
"None of this is necessary," Koga said discordantly. "If your Congress had just given me a chance to..."
"Sir, maybe that's right. I don't know if it is or not, but maybe it is," Chavez said. "That doesn't much matter now, does it?"
"Tell me, then, what does matter?"
"Ending this goddamn thing before too many people get hurt," Clark suggested.
I fought in wars, and they're not fun. Lots of young kids get to die before they have the chance to get married and have kids of their own. And that's bad, okay? Clark paused before going on. It's bad for my country, and for damn sure it's going to be worse for yours. Yamada thinks Yamada is a businessman, Chavez said. Sir, you'd better understand this. He doesn't know what he's started.
Yes. You Americans are very good at killing. I saw that myself 15 minutes ago.
In that case, Mr. Koga, you also saw that we left one man alive. Clark's angry reply stopped conversation cold for several seconds. Koga was slow to realize that it was true. The one outside the door had been alive when they'd walked over his body, moaning and shuddering as though from electric shocks, but definitely alive.
Why didn't you?
There was no reason to kill him, Chavez said. I'm not going to apologize for that Kaneda bastard. He had it coming, and when I came into the room, he was reaching for a weapon, and that's tough cookies, sir. But this isn't a movie. We don't kill people for amusement, and we came in to rescue you because somebody has to end this goddamn war. Okay?
Even then, what your Congress did, how can my country survive economically?
Will it be better for anybody if the war goes on? Clark asked. If Japan and China kick off against Russia, what happens to you then? Who do you suppose will really pay the price for that mistake? China? I don't think so. The first word in Washington came via satellite. One of NSA's orbiting hitchhiker Elint birds happened to be overhead to record the termination of signal, that was the NSA term for it, from 3 AEW aircraft. Other NSA listening posts recorded radio chatter that lasted for several minutes before ending. Analysts were trying to make sense of it now, the report in Ryan's hands told him. Only one kill, the colonel told himself. Well, he'd have to be content with that. His wingman had bagged the last of the 15 J's. The southern element had gotten 3, and the strike eagles had gotten the other 4 when their support had been cut off, leaving them suddenly and unexpectedly vulnerable. Presumably, the Zorro team had gotten the 3rd E-767. On the whole, not a bad night's work, but a long one, he thought, forming his flight of 4 back up for the rendezvous with the tanker and the 3 hours back to Shemya. The hardest part was the enforced radio silence. Some of his people had to be counting coups in a big way, full of themselves in the way of fighter pilots who'd done the job and lived to tell the tale, and wanting to talk through it. That would change shortly, he thought, the enforced silence forcing him to think about his first ever air-to-air kill. 30 people on the aircraft. Damn, he was supposed to feel good about a kill, wasn't he? So why didn't he? Something interesting had just happened, Dutch Claggett thought. They were still catching bits and pieces of the SSK in their area, but whoever it was, it had turned north and away from them, allowing Tennessee to remain on station. In the way of submarines on patrol, he'd come close enough to the surface to put up his ESM antenna and track the Japanese radar aircraft for the past day or so, learning what he could for possible forwarding to others. Electronic intelligence gathering had been a submarine mission since before his application to Annapolis, and his crew included 2 electronics techs who showed a real aptitude for it. But they'd had 2 on the monitoring systems that had just gone poof. Then they'd caught some radio chatter, excited by the sound of it, and one by one those voices had gone off the air somewhere to his north.
"You suppose we just got up on the scoreboard, Captain?" Lieutenant Shaw asked, expecting the captain to know, because captains were supposed to know everything, even though they didn't.
"Seems that way."
"Con. Sonar.
Con eye.
Our friend is snorting again, bearing 009, probable CZ contact," the sonar chief thought.
"I'll start the track," Shaw said, heading aft for the plotting table.
"So, what happened?" Durling asked.
"We killed 3 of their radar aircraft, and the strike force annihilated their fighter patrol. This was not a time, however, for gloating."
"This is the twitchiest part."
Ryan nodded. "Yes, sir. We need them confused for a while longer, but for now they know something is happening. They know
it might be a real war after all. Any word on Koga?"
"Not yet." It was 4 in the morning, and all three men were showing it. Koga was over the stress period for the moment, trying to use his head instead of his emotions, while his two hosts, that was how he thought of them, rather to his surprise, drove him around and wondered how smart it was to have left the one guard alive outside Yamada's condo. He would be up and moving by now? Would he call the police? Someone else? What would result from the night's adventure?
"How do I know that I can trust you?" Koga asked after a lengthy silence.
Clark's hand squeezed the wheel hard enough to leave fingerprints in the plastic. It was the movies and TV that caused dumbass questions like that. In those media, spies did all manner of complicated things in the hope of outsmarting the equally brilliant adversaries against whom they were pitted. Reality was different. You kept operations as simple as you could, because even the simplest things could blow up on you, and if the other guy was so goddamn brilliant, you wouldn't even know who the hell he was. And tricking people into doing the things you wanted them to do was something that only worked if you arranged a single option for the other guy. And even then, he'd often as not do something unexpected anyway.
"Sir, we've just put our lives at risk for you, but okay, don't trust us at all. I'm not dumb enough to tell you what to do. I don't know your politics well enough for that. What I'm telling you is very simple. We will be doing things. What all of them are, I do not know anyway, so I can't tell you. We want to end this war with a minimum of violence, but there will be violence. You also want the war to end, right?"
"Of course I want it to end," Koga said, his manners not helped by his fatigue.
"Well, sir, you do whatever you think is best, okay? You see, Mr. Koga, you don't have to trust us, but we sure as hell have to trust you to do what's best for your country and for ours."
Clark's comment, exasperated as it was, turned out to be the best thing he could have said.
"Oh, the politician thought that one over."
"Yes, that's right, isn't it?
Where can we drop you off?"
"Kimura's home," Koga said at once.
"Fine." Clark dredged up the location and turned the car onto Route 122 to head for it. Then he reminded himself that he'd learned one highly important thing this night, and that after getting this guy to a place of relative safety, his top priority was getting that information to Washington. The empty streets helped, and though he wished for coffee to keep himself alert, it was a mere 40 minutes to the crowded neighborhood of diminutive tract homes where the meaty official lived. The lights were already on when they pulled up to the house, and they just let Koga out to walk to the door. Isamu Kimura answered the door and took his guest inside with a mouth almost as wide as the entrance to his home.
"Whoever said these people didn't show emotion?" Clark asked himself.
"Who do you suppose the leaker is?" Ding asked, still in the back seat.
"Good boy. You caught that, too."
"Hey, I'm the only college graduate in the car, Mr. C."
Ding opened the computer to draft the dispatch to Langley, again via Moscow.
"They did what?"
Yamada snarled into the phone.
"This is serious. It was General Arima, and he'd just gotten the word from Tokyo himself. They smashed our air defenses and just went away afterwards."
"How?"
the industrialist demanded. "Hadn't they told him that the Kami aircraft were invincible?"
"They don't know yet, but I'm telling you this is very serious. They have the ability to raid the home islands now."
"Think," Yamada told himself, shaking his head to clear the cobwebs.
"General, they still cannot invade our islands, can they?
They can sting us, but they cannot really hurt us. And as long as we have nuclear weapons,
unless they try something else, the Americans are not acting as we have been given to expect."
The remark stung the next governor of Saipan. Today was supposed to have been the day on which he'd begin his campaign. Well, yes, he'd overestimated the effect his action would have on the American financial markets, but they had crippled the American fleet, and they had occupied the islands, and America did not have the ability to storm even one of the Marianas, and America did not have the political will to launch a nuclear attack on his country. Therefore, they were still ahead of the game. Was it to be expected that America would not fight back somewhat? Of course not. Yamada lifted his TV controller and switched it on, catching the beginning of a CNN headline news broadcast.
and there was the American correspondent standing right on the edge of some dock or other, and there behind her were two American carriers still in their docks, still unable to do anything.
"What does the intelligence tell us about the Indian Ocean?" he asked the general.
"The two American carriers are still there," Arima assured him. "They were seen both visually and on radar yesterday within 400 kilometers of Sri Lanka."
"Then they cannot really hurt us, can they?"
"Well, no, really they cannot," the general admitted. "But we must make other arrangements."
"Then I suggest you make them, Arima-san."
Yamata replied in a voice so polite as to constitute a stinging insult.
The worst part was not knowing what had happened. The data links from the three dead Kami aircraft had ended with the elimination of two. All the rest of their information was inferred rather than actually known. Ground-based monitoring stations had copied the emissions of 4 and 6 and then seen those emissions stop within the same minute. There had been no obvious alarm for any of the three radar aircraft. They just stopped transmitting, leaving nothing more behind than floating debris on the rolling ocean. The fighters, well, they did have tapes of the radio conversations. It had taken less than 4 minutes for that. First, the confident, professionally laconic comments of fighter pilots closing on targets, then a series of "what's?" followed by hurried calls to go active with their radars, more calls that they'd been illuminated. One pilot had reported a hit, then immediately gone off the air. But a hit from what? How could the same aircraft that killed the commies have gotten the fighters, too? The Americans had only 4 of their expensive new F-22s, and the commies had been tracking those. What evil magic had... But that was the problem. They didn't know. The air defense specialists and the engineers who developed the world's finest airborne radar systems shook their heads, looking down, feeling immense personal disgrace and not knowing why. Of the 10 such aircraft built, 5 were destroyed and only 4 others available for service, and all they knew for sure was that they couldn't risk them over water anymore. Orders were also issued to deploy the standby E-2C aircraft that the E-767s had replaced, but those were less capable American designs, and the officers had to accept the fact that somehow the air defenses of their country had been severely compromised. It was 7 in the evening, and Ryan was about to leave for home when the secure fax machine started buzzing. His phone started ringing even before paper appeared.
"Can't you people ever keep secrets?" an accented voice demanded angrily.
"Sergei, what's the problem? Koga is our best chance for terminating hostilities, and someone on your side told the Japanese that he's in contact with you."
Golovko nearly shouted from his home, where it was 3 in the morning.
"Do you want to kill the man?"
"Sergei Nikolaevich, will you, for Christ's sake, settle the hell down?" Jack sat back down in his chair, and by this time he had the page to read. It had come directly from the U.S. Embassy communications people in Moscow, doubtless on orders of a sort from the RVS.
Oh, shit. Pause. Okay, we got him out of trouble, didn't we?
You're penetrated at the high level, Ivan Ametovich.
Well, you should know how easy it is to do that.
We're working to find out who it is, I assure you.
The voice was still angry. Wouldn't that be great, Jack thought, behind painfully closed eyes. The Russian Foreign Intelligence Service testifies in federal district court.
Not many people know this. I'll get back to you.
I am so pleased to hear that you restrict sensitive information to such trustworthy people, Jack.
The line went dead. Ryan depressed the switch and punched up another number from memory.
Murray.
Ryan, Dan, I need you here in a hurry. Jack's next call was to Scott Adler. Then he walked off again toward the president's office. The positive news he had to report, Ryan supposed, was that the other side had used important information clumsily. Yamata, again, he was sure, acting like a businessman rather than a professional spook. He hadn't even troubled himself to disguise the information he had, not caring that it would also reveal its source. The man didn't know his limitations. Sooner or later, he'd pay dearly for that weakness.
Jackson's last set of orders before heading off to the Pacific had involved ordering 12 B-1B bombers of the 384th Bomb Wing to fly east from their base in southern Kansas, first to Lajes in the Azores, staging on from there toward Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. The flight of 10,000 miles took more than a day, and when the aircraft arrived at the base farthest from America of any, the crews were thoroughly exhausted. The three KC-10s that brought along ground crewmen and support equipment landed soon thereafter, and the entire assembly of people was soon asleep.
"What do you mean?" Yamata demanded. It was a chilling thought. His own home had been invaded. By whom?
"I mean Koga has disappeared and Kaneda is dead. One of your security people is still alive, but all he saw was two or three gaijin. They disabled him, and he doesn't even know how."
"What is being done?"
"It's being handled as a police matter," Kazuo Taoka told his boss.
"Of course, I didn't tell them about Koga." "He must be found, and quickly."
Yamata looked out the window. Luck was still with him. The call, after all, had caught him at home.
"I don't know, I do. Thank you for the information."
Yamata killed the line, then placed another call. Murray hurried through White House security, having left his service pistol in his official car. His month had not been any better than the rest of the government's. He'd blown the Linders case with a rookie mistake. Brandy plus a cold medication, he said to himself yet again, wondering just what Ryan and the president would have to say to him about that. The criminal case had come apart, and his only satisfaction was that at least he had not brought a possibly innocent man to trial and further embarrassed the Bureau. Whether or not Ed Keelty was really guilty of anything was a side issue for the FBI executive. If you couldn't prove it to a jury, then the defendant was innocent, and that was that, and the man would soon be leaving government service for good. That was something, Murray told himself, as the Secret Service agent conducted him not to Ryan's office, but to the one at the opposite corner of the West Wing. "Hi, Dan," Jack said, standing when he came in. "Mr. President," Murray said first. He didn't know the other man in the room.
"Hi, I'm Scott Adler."
"Hello, sir." Murray took his hand. Oh, that was the guy running the negotiations with the Japs, he realized. Some work had already been accomplished. Ryan could not believe that Adler was the leak. The only others who knew were himself, the president, Brett Hansen, Ed and Mary Pat, and perhaps a few secretaries, and Christopher Cook. "How close are we keeping tabs on Japanese diplomats?" Ryan asked.
"They don't move around without somebody keeping an eye on them," Murray assured them.
"We're talking espionage?" "Probably. Something very important leaked out."
"It has to be Cook," Adler said. "It just has to be."
"Okay. There are some things you need to know," the National Security Advisor said. "Less than 3 hours ago, we slam-dunked their air defenses. We think we killed 10 or 11 aircraft. He could have gone further, but did not. It was still possible that Adler was the leak after all, and the next step of Operation Zorro had to come as a surprise."
"That's going to make them nervous. And they still have nuclear weapons. A bad combination, Jack," the Deputy Secretary of State pointed out.
"Nukes," Murray thought. "Jesus."
"Any changes in their negotiating position?" the President asked.
Adler shook his head. "None, sir. They will offer us Guam back, but they want the rest of the Marianas for themselves. They're not backing off a dot from that, and nothing I've said has shaken them loose."
"Okay," Ryan turned.
"Dan, we've been in contact with Mogotaru Koga."
"He's the ex-prime minister, right?"
Dan asked, wanting to make sure he was up to speed on this. Jack nodded.
"Correct. We have two CIA officers in Japan covered as Russians, and they met with Koga under that cover, but Koga got himself kidnapped by the guy who we think is running the whole show. He told Koga that he knew about contacts with Americans."
"It has to be Cook," Adler said again. "Nobody else on the delegation knows, and Chris does my informal contacts with their number two, Seiji Nagumo." The diplomat paused, then let his anger show. "It's just perfect, isn't it?"
"Espionage investigation?" Murray asked. Significantly, he saw the president let Ryan handle the answer. "Fast and quiet, Dan." "And then?" Adler wanted to know. "If it's him, we flip the bastard right over." Murray nodded at once on hearing the FBI euphemism.
"What do you mean, Jack?" Durling asked.
"It's a real opportunity. They think they have a good intel source, and they've shown the willingness to use the information from it." "Okay," Jack said. "We can use that to our advantage. We give them some juicy information, and then we stick it right up their ass." The most immediate need was to buttress the air defenses for the home islands. The realization caused no small amount of thinking at Japanese defense headquarters, and most uncomfortably, it was based on partial information, not the precise sort of data that had been used to prepare the overall operational plan that the military high command was trying to stick with. The best radar warning systems their country owned were seaborne on the four Congo-class Aegis destroyers patrolling off the northern Marianas. They were formidable ships with self-contained air defense systems. Not quite as mobile as the E-767s, they were more powerful, however, and able to take care of themselves. Before dawn, therefore, an order was flashed out for the four-ship squadron to race north to establish a radar picket line east of the home islands. After all, the U.S. Navy wasn't doing anything, and if their country's defenses came back together, there was yet a good chance for a diplomatic solution. On Mutsu, Admiral Sato saw the logic of it when he receipted the signal and gave orders for his ships to go to their maximum sustained speed. Nonetheless, he was concerned. He knew that his spy radar system could detect stealthy aircraft, something the Americans had demonstrated in tests against their own, and his ships were sufficiently powerful that American aircraft would not lightly engage them. What worried him was that for the first time, his country was not acting but reacting to American moves. That, he hoped, was temporary. "That's interesting," Jones observed at once. The traces were only a few minutes old, but there were two of them, probably representing more than two ships, in a tight formation, making noise and with a slightly northerly bearing change. "Surface ship, sure as hell," OT Second Class Boomer observed. "This looks like pounding." He stopped when Jones circled another trace in red. "And that's a blade rate, 30-plus knots, and that means warships in one big hurry." Jones walked over to the phone and called ComSub Pack. "Bart, Ron, we have something here. The CAN squadron that's been operating around Pagan?"
"What about it?" Mancuso asked.
"They seem to be doing a speed run north. We have anybody up waiting for them?" Then Jones remembered several inquiries about the waters around Honshu. Mancuso wasn't telling him everything, as was to be expected for operational matters. The way he evaded the question would be the real answer, the civilian thought.
"Can you plot me a course?"
"Bingo. Give us a little while, an hour maybe? The data's still a little fuzzy, Skipper." The voice was not overly disappointed at the answer, Jones noted.
"Aye, sir. We'll keep you posted." "Good work, Ron."
Jones replaced the phone and looked around. "Senior Chief, let's start doing a plot on these traces. Somewhere north," he thought. Somebody was waiting. He wondered who it might be and came up with one answer. Time was working in the opposite direction now. Hiroshi Goto opened his cabinet meeting at 10 in the morning local time, which was midnight in Washington where his negotiators were. It was clear that the Americans were making a contest of it, though some in the room thought that it could just be a negotiating ploy, that they had to make some show of force in order to be taken seriously at the negotiating table. Yes, they had stung the air defense people badly, but that was all. America could not and would not launch systematic attacks against Japan. The risks were too great. Japan had nuclear-tipped missiles, for one thing. For another, Japan had sophisticated air defenses despite the events of the previous night, and then there was simple arithmetic. How many bombers did America have? How many could strike at their country, even if there were nothing to stop them? How long would such a bombing campaign take? Did America have the political will for it? The answers to all of these questions were favorable to their country, the cabinet members thought.
their eyes still fixed on the ultimate goal whose shining prize glittered before them. And besides, each man in this room had a patron of sorts to make sure that they took the proper spin on things. Except Goto, they knew, whose patron was elsewhere at the moment. For the moment, the ambassador in Washington would object strongly to the American attack on Japan and note that it was not a helpful act and that there would be no further concessions until they were stopped. It would be further noted that any attack on the Japanese mainland would be considered an exceedingly grave matter. After all, Japan had not attacked vital American interests directly, yet. That threat behind the thinnest of veils would surely bring some rationality to the situation. Goto nodded agreement to the suggestions, wishing that his own patron were about to support him, and knowing that Yamada had already bypassed him and spoken with defense officials directly. He'd have to talk to Raizo about that.
"And if they come back," he asked, "we'll have our defenses at maximum alert tonight, and when the destroyers arrive on station, they will be as formidable as before."
"Yes, they have made their show of force, but they have not as yet so much as flown over our territory."
"We must do more than that," Goto said, recalling his instructions. "We can put more pressure on the Americans by making our ultimate weapons public."
"No," a minister said at once. "That will cause chaos here."
"It will also cause chaos there," Goto replied. Somewhat weakly, the rest of the cabinet thought. Again, they saw, he was voicing the thoughts and orders of someone else. They knew who that was. "It will force them to alter the tone of their negotiations."
"It could easily force them to consider a grave attack on us."
"They have too much to lose," Goto insisted.
"And we do not," the minister shot back, wondering just where his loyalty to his patron ended and his loyalty to his countrymen began.
"What if they decide to preempt?"
"They cannot. They don't have the weapons to do it. Our missiles have been very carefully located."
"Yes, and our air defense systems are invincible, too," another minister snorted.
"Perhaps the best thing to do is for our ambassador to suggest that we might reveal that we have the atomic weapons."
"Perhaps that would be enough," a third minister suggested.
There were some nods around the table, and Goto, despite his instructions, agreed to that.
The hardest part was keeping warm, despite all the cold weather gear they brought along. Richter snuggled himself into the sleeping bag and allowed himself to be vaguely guilty for the fact that the Rangers had to maintain listening outposts around the Rump airfield they'd established on this frigid mountainside. His principal worry was a system failure in one of the three aircraft. Despite all the redundancies built into them, there were several items which, if they broke, could not be fixed. The Rangers knew how to fuel the birds and how to load weapons, but that was about it. Richter had already decided to let them worry about ground security. If so much as a platoon showed up in this high meadow, they were doomed. The Rangers could kill every intruder. But one radio call could have a battalion here in an hour, and there was no surviving that.
Special operations, he thought. They were good so long as they worked, just like everything else you did in uniform. But the current situation had a safety margin so thin that you could see through it. Then there was the issue of getting out, the pilot reminded himself. He might as well have joined the Navy.
Nice house. The rules were different in time of war, Murray told himself. Computers made it easier, a fact that the Bureau had been slow to learn. Assembling his team of young agents, the first task had been to run nothing more sophisticated than a credit check, which gave an address. The house was somewhat upscale, but within the reach, barely, of a super-grade federal employee, if he saved his pennies over the years. That was something Cook had not done, he saw. The man did all his banking at First Virginia, and the FBI had a man able to break into the bank records far enough to see that, like most people, Christopher Cook had lived largely from one biweekly paycheck to the next, saving a mere $14,000 along the way, probably for the college education of his kids, and that, Murray knew, was on the dumb side of optimistic, what with the cost of American higher education. More to the point, when he'd settled on the new house, the savings had gone untouched.
He had a mortgage, but the amount was less than $200,000, and with the $180,000 realized from the sale of his previous home, that left a sizable gap that bank records could not explain. Where had the other money come from? A call to a contact at the IRS proposing a possible case of tax evasion had turned up other computerized records, enough to show that there was no additional family income to explain it. A check of antecedents showed that the parents of both the cooks, all deceased, had not left either husband or wife with a windfall. Their cars, a further check showed, were paid for, and while one of them was 4 years old, another was a Buick that probably had the original smell still inside, and that also had been purchased with cash. What they had was a man living beyond his means, and while the government had often enough failed to make note of that in espionage cases, it had learned a little of late. "Well," Murray asked his people, "it's not a case yet, but it sure as hell smells like one," the next senior agent thought. "We need to visit some banks and get a look at more records," for which a court order was required, but they already knew which judge to go to for that. The FBI always knew which judges were tame and which were not. Similar checks, of course, had been run on Scott Adler, who they found was divorced, living alone in a Georgetown flat, paying alimony and child support, driving a nice car, but otherwise very normal. Secretary Hansen was quite wealthy from years of practicing law and a poor subject for attempted bribery. The extensive background checks run on all the subjects for their government offices and security clearances were re-examined and found to be normal, except for Cook's recent auto and home purchases. Somewhere along the line, they'd find a canceled check drawn on some bank or other to explain the easy house settlement. That was one nice thing about banks. They had records on everything, and it was always on some sort of paper, and it always left a trail. "Okay, we will proceed on the assumption that he is our boy," the deputy assistant director looked around at the bright group of agents, who, like him, had neglected to consider the possibility that Barbara Linders had been on a prescription medication that had acted with the brandy Ed Keelty had once kept close at all times. Their collective embarrassment was as great as his own. Not an entirely bad thing, Dan thought. You worked hard to restore your credibility after a goof. Jackson felt the hard thump of the carrier landing, then the snapping deceleration of the arrestor wire as he was pressed hard into the back-facing passenger seat of the COD. Another odious experience over, he thought. He much preferred to land on a carrier with his own two hands on the controls, uncomfortable with trusting his life to some teenage lieutenant, or so they now all looked to the admiral. He felt the aircraft turn to the right, heading off to an unoccupied portion of the flight deck, and presently a door opened and he hustled out. A deck crewman saluted, pointing him to an open door in the carrier's island structure. The ship's bell was there, and as soon as he got under cover, a marine saluted, and a bosun's mate worked the striker on the bell, announcing into the IMC unit, "Task Force 77 arriving." "Welcome aboard, sir," Bud Sanchez said with a grin, looking very natty in his flight suit. "Captain's on the bridge, sir." "Then let's get to work." "How's the leg, Robbie?" the CAG asked halfway up the third ladder. "Stiff as hell after all the sitting." It had taken time, the briefing at Pearl Harbor, the Air Force flight to Aniwatuk, then waiting for the C-2A to show up to bring him to his command. Jackson was beyond jet lag, but for all that, eager now, about noon, he thought, according to where the sun was. "Is the cover story holding?" Sanchez asked next. "No telling, Bud, until we get there." Jackson allowed a Marine to open the door to the wheelhouse. His leg really was stiff, just one more reminder that flight operations were over for him. "Welcome aboard, sir," the CO said, looking up from a sheaf of dispatches. The roar of afterburners told Jackson that Johnny Reb was conducting flight operations, and he looked quickly forward to see a Tomcat leap off the port forward cat. The carrier was about halfway between the Carolines and Wake. The latter island was somewhat closer to the Marianas, and for that reason was not being used for anything. Wake had a fine airfield, still supported by the Air Force. Aniwatuk was just a recovery field, known to be such, and therefore made a more covert base for staging aircraft, if a far less convenient one for maintaining them.
Okay, what's been happening since I left Pearl? Jackson asked.
Some good news. The CO handed over one of the dispatches.
It's definite as hell, Jones said, leaning over the sonar traces.
They're sure in a hurry, Mancuso agreed, his eyes plotting speed and distance, and not liking what they saw, further confirming what Jones suspected.
Who's waiting for them?
Ron, we can't.
Sir, I can't be much help to you if I don't know, Jones observed reasonably. You think I'm a security risk or something?
Mancuso thought for a few seconds before answering.
Tennessee's lying right over top the Oshunadaoki Seamount, supporting a special operation that goes off in the next 24 hours.
And the rest of the Ohio's?
Just off Ulithi Atoll, heading north a little slower now. The SSN force will lead the carrier in. The Ohio's are tasked to get inside early. Which all made sense, Jones thought. The boomers were too slow to operate effectively with a carrier task force, which he'd also been tracking on Sosus, but they were ideal for getting inside a patrol line of SSKs, so long as the skippers were smart about it. There was always that consideration.
The Jap cans will be about on top of Tennessee, right about...
I know.
What else do you have for me? ComSupPac asked briskly.
Jones led him over to the wall chart. There were now 7 SSK silhouettes circled on the display, with only one question mark marked.
That one, they saw, was in the passage between the northernmost of the Marianas, called Mog, and the Bonins, the most famous of which was Iwo Jima.
We've been trying to concentrate on this passage, Jones said. I've gotten a few twitches, but nothing firm enough to plot. If I were them, though, I'd cover that area.
So would I, Chambers confirmed.
One likely move for the Americans would be to put a submarine patrol line astride the Luzon Strait to attempt to interdict oil traffic to the Japanese mainland. That was a political decision, however. Pacific Fleet did not yet have authorization to attack Japanese merchantmen, and intelligence reported that at the moment most of the tanker traffic in and out was composed of flag-of-convenience shipping, attacks on which had all sorts of political ramifications.
We couldn't risk offending Liberia, Mancuso told himself with a grimace.
Could we?
Why the speed run for the cans back home, Jones asked. It was not something that appeared very sensible.
We hammered their air defenses last night.
Okay, so they'll scoot west of the Bonins. That means I'll lose them soon. Anyway, their speed of advance is 32 and their course is still a little fuzzy, but homeward bound sure as hell.
Jones paused.
We're starting to play with their heads, huh?
Mancuso allowed himself a smile for once.
Always.
Chapter 44 From One Who Knows the Score.
Does it have to be this way? Derling asked.
We've run the simulation 20 times, Ryan said, flipping through the data yet again. It's a matter of certainty, sir. We have to take them all the way out.
The president looked at the satellite overheads again.
We're still not 100% sure, are we?
Jack shook his head. Nothing is ever that sure, no. Our data looks pretty good. The overheads, I mean. The Russians have developed data, too, and they have as much reason to want to be right as we do. There are 10 birds here. They're dug in deep, and the site seems to have been selected deliberately for relative immunity from attack. Those are all positive indicators. This is not a deception operation. The next question is making sure that we can hit them all, and we have to do it quickly.
Why?
Because they're moving ships back toward the coast that are marginally capable of detecting the aircraft.
No other way?
No, Mr. President. If this is going to work, it has to be tonight.
And the night Ryan saw, checking his watch, had already started on the far side of the world.
We protest in the strongest terms the American attack on our country, the ambassador began. We have refrained at all times from doing such things, and we expected a similar courtesy from the United States.
Mr. Ambassador, I am not consulted on military operations. Have American forces struck your mainland?
Adler asked by way of reply.
You know quite well that they have done, and you must also know that it is a precursor move to a full attack. It is important that you understand, the diplomat went on,
that such an attack could result in the gravest possible consequences. He let that phrase hang in the air like a cloud of lethal gas. Adler took a moment before responding.
I would remind you, first of all, that we did not begin this conflict. I would further remind you that your country made a deliberate attack to cripple our economy,
as you have done, the ambassador shot back, showing real anger that might have been a cover for something else.
Excuse me, sir, but I believe it is my turn to speak.
Adler waited patiently for the ambassador to calm down. It was plain that neither one had gotten a full night's sleep.
I would further remind you that your country has killed American servicemen, and if you expected us to refrain from corresponding moves, then you were possibly mistaken in that expectation.
We have never attacked vital American interests.
The freedom and security of American citizens is ultimately my country's only vital interest, sir.
The acrimonious change in atmosphere could hardly have been more obvious, as was the reason for it. America was making a move of some sort, and the move would clearly not be a subtle one. The people on both sides of the table, again on the top floor of the State Department, might well have been carved from stone. No one wanted to concede anything, not even a blink at the formal sessions. Heads might have turned fractionally when the leaders of the respective delegations took their turns to speak, but no more than that. The absence of facial expressions would have done professional gamblers proud, but that was precisely the game being played, even without cards or dice.
The discussions never got as far before the first recess as a return to the possession of the Marianas.
Christ, Scott, Cook said, walking through the doors to the terrace. From the circles under his eyes, the chief negotiator he saw had been up most of the night, probably at the White House. The primary season would be driving this mess now. The media were harping on the crippled ships at Pearl Harbor, and TV coverage was also coming from Saipan and Guam now, people speaking with obscured faces and disguised voices, on one hand about how they wanted to be American citizens, and on the other how much they feared being on those islands if a real counterattack developed.
The ambivalence was exactly the sort of thing to confuse the public, and opinion polls were divided, though with a majority expressing outrage at what had been done, and a slightly smaller majority expressing the wish for a diplomatic solution, if possible. A plurality of 46%, the Washington Post ABC poll had stated this morning, didn't see much hope of that. The wild card, however, was the Japanese possession of nuclear arms, which had been announced by neither country, in both cases, for fear of panicking the respective populations. Everyone in these sessions had really hoped for a peaceful settlement, but much of that hope had just evaporated, and in a period of a mere 2 hours.
It's being politically driven now, Adler explained, looking away, to let out his own tension with a long breath.
It had to happen, Chris.
What about their nukes?
The Deputy Secretary of State shrugged uneasily.
We don't think they're that crazy.
We don't think they are? What genius came up with that assessment? Cook demanded.
Ryan, who else? Adler paused.
He's running this. He thinks the next smart move is to blockade. Well, declare a maritime exclusion zone, like the Brits did down at the Falklands. Cut off their oil, Adler explained.
1941 all over again? I thought that bonehead was a historian. That's what started a world war, in case anybody forgot.
The threat of it. Well, if Koga has the guts to speak out, we think their government will come apart.
So, Scott went on,
find out what the other side. I mean, what sort of strength the opposition really has.
It's a dangerous game we're playing, man.
Sure enough, Adler agreed, looking right in the man's eyes.
Cook turned and walked to the other side of the terrace. Before it had seemed a normal part of the proceedings to Adler, part of the rubric of serious negotiations, and how stupid that had been for the real proceedings to be handled over coffee and tea and cookies because the real negotiators didn't want to risk making statements that,
well, those were the rules, he reminded himself,
and the other side had made very skillful use of them.
He watched the two men talk. The Japanese ambassador looked far more uneasy than his principal subordinate.
"What are you really thinking?" Adler would have killed to know that. It was too easy to think of the man as a personal enemy now, which would be a mistake. He was a professional.